You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Abraham Reisman is my guest. He is a journalist, and he has just published a biography of Stan Lee. The book is called True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. Abraham Reisman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I enjoyed your book very much. And there have been other biographies of Stan Lee. So did his death afford you an opportunity that other biographers didn't have, or in what other ways is the book different?
There's a few factors. I don't want to denigrate anybody else's work, but I felt like there were a lot of frontiers that had not been explored in Stan's life or had not been fully explored that I could try and dig into. I will say, initially when I was approached about this book, because I didn't pitch it, they came to me, I was skeptical because I thought, well, what is there to say about Stan that hasn't been said, including by me, as I had written a long profile of him a few years before that. But, friends sort of slapped some sense into me and said, don't say no to this offer. This isn't the kind of thing you say no to. And then once I started thinking about it, I realized, well, there are a lot of question marks that exist for things ranging from Stan's Jewish identity to what was happening behind the scenes at his two post-Marvel companies, you know, a lot of stuff that hadn't really been looked at. And, you know, Stan being having passed away before I started doing the research also changes the game a little bit because, you know, you can tell a more complete story. You know, I mean, it's morbid to say, but that is something that happens when you're doing a posthumous biography. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, because I hadn't, interviewed him, you know, I was never able to interview him for the profile or for this. I did a brief email interview with him for the profile, but it wasn't very substantive. That meant I was operating from a place of not really being beholden to, the subject, or necessarily having been, you know, caught up in the way the subject talked about himself, because, you know, that was something that tripped up a lot of journalists over the course of the decades. Was Stan was extremely charming, a great raconteur and a fun guy to hang out with. And he was great at telling stories about himself. Now, those stories were very often not true, but people, or at least, you know, very exaggerated. But you know, journalists really got taken by it. And I think maybe the fact that I was writing from a perspective of not having had that direct interaction maybe had some kind of effect.
You approached this book as more of as an investigative journalist than, say, mm-hmm. a biographer. Is that fair to say?
I suppose, yeah. I'm very flattered you'd say that. I don't think of myself as being, you know, in the same league as a lot of the formal investigative journalists that I know, but I did try to pick up some of their strategies and their sort of overall approach of not really taking anything at face value once I was approaching the book. So I appreciate you saying that. I was trying to do as much investigation as I could.
Well, what about you, Abraham Reisman? Are you
a comic book
reader? Or did you love comic books growing up?
Did you? I did. Yeah, I grew up initially before comics, before I was reading comics even, I was familiar with Marvel products through their cartoons. I'm a millennial, so I came up watching Marvel cartoons in the early 90s. There was a Spider-Man one, an X-Men one, and then this sort of miscellaneous Marvel character one called the Marvel Action Hour. And the latter was how I was first introduced to Stan, because Stan would do these little live action intros to the Marvel Action Hour, mm-hmm. Which I found out during my research was because since it was this show where they would have miscellaneous characters popping in and out, they didn't want kids to get confused by thinking, well, there's no consistency from episode to episode. So they decided to have Stan be the through line. That was my initial exposure, that and this little tiny book that I actually have here in my room with me, still surviving from a first grade scholastic book fair called the Marvel Superheroes Guidebook, which is just this tiny little volume written for grade schoolers that just sort of introduces you to the Marvel universe and all the cool vehicles and all the famous storylines and everything. And then as I got older, I started reading comics and, by the end of grade school was a big Marvel head and, you know, kept going with that throughout my teen years. College, I sort of dropped off a little bit. After college, I especially dropped off. And then, you know, for various reasons, kind of got back into comics around, you know, a few years after I'd been out of college. And then because I'm an obsessive workaholic and I try to turn everything that I find interesting into work because that's how I motivate myself. I started writing about the comic book industry. You know, I'd been a journalist for a number of years at that point, but hadn't really turned comics into a subject of mine. And then, you know, had this moment in the early 2010s, you know, I started writing about comics in 2013. And it was really a case of being in the right place at the right time, because comic book adaptations at that point, movies and television shows, were starting to reach this real critical mass. And there was, I guess, need in the marketplace or hunger in the marketplace for stories about the stories behind those stories, you know, looking for the origins of a character or a storyline or whatever. And, you know, one thing led to another, and suddenly I was doing a lot of that. I went beyond your question, so I apologize.
No, not at all. Did you, in part of your research then, you know, did you read, obviously when you came to comics in, you know, in the last 20 years, you know, there had already been 70 years of comics. So, and in case of, you know, Marvel, a good 40 years before you got there. So did you go back and read Spider-Man 1?
When I was young, I didn't really, because it was hard to get your hands on that stuff, actually. Reprints were not, you know, a cottage industry within comics. It was a very different landscape as of the late 90s. You know, there were trade collections of comics, but they were not as easy to come by as you might think, and were not as complete as you might think. So it really was only in adulthood that I started going back and reading the old comics in any kind of systematic way. Because that was, it just wasn't an option that was really available to me in, you know, suburban Illinois, back when I was growing up.
Right. So, but when you were working on True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, did you read, you know, the first 100 issues of FF?
What's funny is you know, I'll be completely honest, in the name of triage, I didn't spend that much time doing that. I'd read a lot of them already, but more important, you know, I only had a year to write this book, and I figured there's a lot that's already been written about the comics themselves. And also, you know, for reasons we can get into later in the conversation, it's really hard to say exactly who was writing these comics and how much of anything in there was Stan's idea. So I, you know, I certainly read a lot of comics for it, but I decided to err on the side of spending more time doing research into Stan's life and what happened to him and the lives of the people around him, as opposed to, you know, focusing primarily on the content of these comic books. So I certainly read a bunch, but I did not sit down and read the full corpus of Stan's work. I mean, there's so much that he was at least credited on or involved with.
Right. Well, so now you've cracked the egg about what the kind of you know, in some ways the main focus of your book is, which is whether or not Stan Lee is a liar, or I guess is an unpolite way of putting it. I mean, did you find when you were writing the book, do you like Stan Lee?
I'm not sure you really have to think about it that way. I mean, I certainly empathize with him. He's a human being. We're all filled with contradictions and shortcomings and relationships that can be positive or toxic, whatever. I don't think it's really the job of the biographer to like or dislike their subject, unless it's in very special cases, I guess. You know, if you're, you know, biographizing somebody who's done completely reprehensible things, but even then you want to have empathy for the person, and try to just, if for no other reason, then that's the only way to write a truthful biography, is if you try and put yourself in their shoes to a certain extent. So I don't know. I certainly see a lot of the things that Stan did and said to be, you know, maybe not a lot, but a fair number of them to be distasteful. I mean, the two big that jump out, ones that jump out of my mind are, you know, A, there's the tapes or recordings I heard of him late in life saying racist and homophobic things, which obviously, you know, I'm a queer man and not into racism. So that was a little rough, but, also labor rights. You know, I'm somebody who cares a lot about rights for people who work, and especially for creative people, because, you know, I consider myself being in the creative world, even if it's nonfiction that I'm doing, it's a similar set of questions and skills. And, you know, Stan was not great on labor rights. You know, he was not the worst at, in the comics industry when it came to exploiting workers, but he certainly did his fair amount of exploitation. And that's something that, you know, it's not like I sit around going, you know, I hate this man, but I certainly am aware of that being something that I wish he'd been better on.
Right, right. There's a story in your book that was familiar to me because I knew the artist Dick Ayers.
Oh, you did? And, no kidding.
Yeah. And I sat with him in his studio one day in White Plains, New York. And he told me a story that is in your book. He didn't tell it exactly the way it's in your book, but he
said, the Sergeant Fury story?
Right, right. Why don't you tell the story?
Yeah. So Dick Ayers, who was, you know, one of the people working on comics with Stan, he was an artist and an inker. He was working on this comic called Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos, which is a war comic. And, you know, I guess to take a step aside, we have to talk about what the Marvel method was. Very brief version of a very complicated thing. The comics that Stan is famous for in the 60s were not written by script. Like, Stan was not sitting down and doing what you would intuitively suspect based on the credits in the comics and on just basic assumptions, which is that he would have, as the credited writer, been one writing a script and then handing it to an artist to illustrate. That was not what was happening. There were conversations of some kind verbally before work on the issue began about what was going to be in the issue. It's unclear and was changing from issue to issue how much of that was Stan dictating, how much of it was his collaborator. But the collaborator in this case was always an artist, or really what you should call them, a writer artist, because what would happen after that conversation was the writer artist would go home. They were all freelancers. You know, Stan talked about a bullpen, but there was none as of then. The writer artist would at home come up with the first draft. And the first draft was visual. You know, you would draw 20 odd pages of comic and put in little margin notes pointing out what's going on or dialogue suggestions, stuff like that. And then the art would come back, this first draft, which is, you know, pretty close to complete, but ready for revisions if need be, back to Stan. And then Stan would come up with the dialogue and narration. So Stan was definitely writing for these comics, but it's, you can pretty safely argue that it was either a 50-50 collaboration or more tilted in the way of the artist in terms of being the primary writer on the thing. So that's all a long way of saying Dick Ayers was having this, there was an issue of Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos that Stan and Dick were working on. And basically Stan couldn't come up with a plot for this one. And so Dick, along with his wife, kind of sweated it out and came up with this plot and brought it to Stan. Stan was into it. The comic, you know, and Dick then did the comic. And afterward, he asked, could I be credited as a writer or a plotter? I can't remember exactly what he asked for, but, you know, get a writing-ish credit. And Stan, according to, I mean, I had a story, the story secondhand, but the person who told that story said that Stan's response was, since when did you get an ego? Get out of here. Now, I'm curious to hear, what was Dick's version when you spoke to him?
He said to me, well, I called Stan and I said, I don't have a story for this this book. I've got to get going on this book. And Stan said to me, well, Dick, you know these characters as well as I do. You can come up with it yourself. So I wrote it. I penciled it. I inked it. Lindy, that was his wife, lettered it. And then the book came out and it said script by Stan Lee. And I said, Stan, don't you think I should have gotten script credit on that? And he said, what are you, an egomaniac?
There you go. Yeah, it's a wild story, but not in by any means, rare. I mean, things like that happened a fair amount.
The crux of your story is kind of in that little
tale. A little bit, yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, I mean, Stan did not give up credit without a fight, even if it was credit that he pre-patently didn't deserve, or at least it deserved to be, you know, have caveats. And yeah, that story about Ayers is very emblematic. He, you know, in Stan's outline for his memoir, which was a key document for me in the book, you know, he has this little section where he talks about when the comics were getting big, the problem was all the artists became, you know, egomaniacs, and all the artists started believing their own hype, which is so fascinating because, you know, you can argue that the exact opposite was what was happening. They were the ones who were, you know, not being able to live up to the hype that was being said about them. And Stan was the one who was sort of going beyond what was necessarily deserved. But that's interesting. I hadn't heard Dick's direct version of that before.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Abraham Reisman. He's the author of a biography of the man behind Marvel Comics, True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee.
Well, so in your book, Abraham Reisman, your book, True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, I think the main rivalry in the story is between Jack Kirby, the artist who created Captain America back in 1941.
Co-created with Joe Simon, but yes.
Yes, and who drew the Fantastic Four and the Hulk and Thor, and Stan. And also, to a certain extent, Steve Ditko, mm-hmm. who drew Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. And the question that's always been asked, even during Stan's lifetime, was, well, who was really the creator of these characters? Mm-hmm. Was it Jack or Stan? And Stan said it was me, and Jack said it was me. And so people thought that it was somewhere in the middle, but you believe that there's a possibility.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that the one of the lessons of the book that is, you know, frustrating, but unfortunately a universal human truth, is you have to sit with ambiguity, whether it's factual ambiguity or moral ambiguity. Unfortunately, there are questions where there are not very easy answers. And when it comes to who created these characters, I don't think we're ever going to have a smoking gun answer one way or the other, because it was comics was an extremely fly by night, janky industry as of the 60s. People were not sitting down and mapping out exactly what work for hire meant or exactly who was creating what and leaving paper trails. All of this stuff was very ephemeral. And, you know, you say meeting somewhere in the middle. I do find it frustrating that a lot of historians and journalists and assorted others have gone, well, Stan said it was all him. Jack said it was all him. It must be somewhere in the middle. When I'm not saying it's not, it could be. It could be that both of them were responsible for co-creating these characters, but it's just a little specious to go, well, the mathematical average here is 50%, as opposed to, well, both men said it was really just all one or the other. So maybe that's the case. You know, I wish I could sound more definitive about these things, but again, it's something you just sort of have to accept, not just about this, but about any number of other things that are factually ambiguous in Stan's story.
In the case of Jack Kirby, when he left Marvel, as you talk about in the book, and went to DC, he did not create a bunch of memorable characters along the lines of the Fantastic Four.
Not at that scale. Not at the, so far at least. There are characters that Jack created in that period that
are now
become bigger in the near to midterm future. But you are right. I mean, the characters that he created at DC immediately after leaving Marvel, although in many ways a lot of them are completely fascinating and are deeply beloved within comics circles and in superhero circles a little more broadly, no, they are not the Fantastic Four, they are not the X-Men, they are not the Avengers. Those are orders of magnitude more popular.
And one of the things that you could say about Kirby's creations post collaborating with Stan Lee, mm-hmm. is that those comics are not funny.
They can be funny at times, but they're not funny. Certainly not funny in the same way. And they're not zippy. I mean, there's definitely humor in there, and that's all very subjective, but it's a different kind. I mean, Jack's dialogue was in no way like Stan's dialogue. You know, it's night and day when you read the words of Jack Kirby, when it's just him writing without anybody doing rewrites. You know, you see a stark contrast between that and his collaborations with Stan.
Also, let me ask this question. Walt Disney, when he made, say, Pinocchio, He didn't write Pinocchio. He didn't draw Pinocchio. He didn't animate Pinocchio. He didn't direct or produce Pinocchio, but Pinocchio is a Walt Disney picture.
Right.
And without Walt Disney, there wouldn't have been a Pinocchio.
Sure. Very true.
Could you say that that standard applies to Stan Lee? That is, in the golden age of Marvel between 1961 and 1970, that those comics are the creations of Stan Lee, whether he wrote them, drew them.
I think that that's it's dangerous to think that way. I think it's certainly true that those characters, the tough word there is creation. Whether they were made popular by Stan, or whether their success was enabled by Stan and would have been impossible without Stan, that's sort of a separate question. And I think the answer for those for that question is, yeah, of course, Stan was instrumental in making those things succeed. The question is the creative one. And, you know, that you talk about Disney and you can talk about, Ub Iwerks, and there are any number of examples beyond just Stan and Jack of two men or two people who were both creative individuals in one field or another. And one of them is a really gifted raconteur and salesman and the other isn't. And then the one who's the raconteur and salesman is the one whose version of history gets written, at least in the first pass. And I think that's in many ways the case of what happened with Stan and Jack. Stan was an extremely good salesman, and not just a good salesman. He was a great editor too. I mean, and for the time, at least, a great writer of dialogue and narration. I would caution against just simply saying, well, because these things wouldn't have succeeded without Stan, therefore they're creations of Stan's. I think that's a little bit of dangerous territory to dance in.
Well, many of the things that made Marvel Comics so enjoyable to a kid in 1966 were, like, for instance, you mentioned the bullpen, which didn't exactly exist, or the Merry Marvel Marching Society, which was a club that you could join, or the No Prize that you might get for having a letter published. I got one once.
Oh, did you? No kidding. What did you point out?
Some kind of an error in Spider-Man's costume or something like that.
Fair enough. Okay.
All of those ideas, none of those ideas were original ideas. The bullpen idea came from EC Comics.
Sure.
Which predates Marvel by a few years. And, Bill Gaines, the publisher of those books, made stars out of his writers and artists because he didn't have continuing characters. And the Merry Marvel Marching Society was from Fawcett Publications. Merry Marvel was Captain Marvel's cohort, and she had a Merry Marvel Marching Society spelled M-A-R-Y. So even that was not an original
lift idea. Yeah, sure.
But the way that Stan put all of those ideas together, and not only did that make for an enjoyable experience, but it really resurrected the comic book industry
totally
from the ashes of the comic book scandal that brought
The moral panic of the 50s. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You're completely right. I mean, culture is a remix. Very rarely is something coming completely sui generis. There's usually precedent for whatever's happening. And the remix, the art of the remix within the context of the creative arts is a delicate and crucial one. I mean, yes, Stan was taking disparate elements that had existed before, whether he was directly lifting them or just doing them after they had already been done, unbeknownst, is hard to say. You can go from example to example, but certainly assembling all that stuff in one place and in one entity was enormously, it was an act of genius. I mean, he was extremely good at figuring out how to connect with his audience, especially in the 60s. After that, it got a little more dicey, but in the 60s, he really, despite being a man in his late 30s and into his early to mid 40s, he was extremely attuned to what teenagers and kids would like in a comic. He was somehow, even despite being by his own verbal admission, a member of the establishment, he was became this counterculture icon. You know, he was really good at taking those elements you talk about and putting them together into a new object, which, you know, even if you can't say that he created these characters necessarily, or there's doubt about that, he really did, you know, it, at least as the co-creator, help create what was Marvel. I mean, I don't want to, you know, diminish that.
It seems also at the same time, DC Comics tried hard to imitate what Marvel was doing.
Yeah.
Marvel, one of Stan Lee's innovations that you talk about in your book is the continuity, not only from one story to the next. You know, you talk about how in the famous Silver Surfer story, you know, the story ends midway through, and then we talk about Johnny
going off to college.
So kind of always keeping you in a soap opera kind of way, going from story to story, but also from book to book, the Submariner appears, and then
Iron Man will fight Daredevil, and they'll then meet up with the X-Men later. And yeah, it's a tremendously important development in the history of really the arts. I mean, for better or worse, this notion that Stan came up with, kind of in an ad hoc way, but still it was his, of having different characters and different series interact with one another in a shared universe where everything to one extent or another counts and matters and lasts. That was something that hadn't really been tried before certainly in superhero comics, but kind of anywhere in the way, at least, that it was manifested in Marvel. And now just look at Hollywood. That's the linchpin of why the Marvel Cinematic Universe has become this addictive substance for billions of people around the world. You keep coming back because in order to understand any given story that you enjoy, you want to fully appreciate it by seeing more of the stories that then inform that story that you want to watch or read or whatever. And, you know, that's something where in my research, I was like, well, I wonder if Jack Kirby claimed credit for that. And I spoke to his assistant and biographer, a guy named Mark Evanier, and he just told me straight up, no, Jack actually didn't like that because it meant when he was writing his stories, he had to incorporate stories from other people, and that was frustrating for him. So really, you can pretty firmly lay the credit for that at Stan's feet. And, you know, beyond just movies, that's something that people have obviously, you know, DC Comics, as you say, then started trying it. But any number of other works of fiction have gone in that direction.
Where DC failed back in the 60s, I think they subsequently succeeded, but, you know, they would try to be hip the way Stan Lee was somehow hip, even though maybe as a person he wasn't, but as an entity, comic books, he was. It always fell flat when it happened in a Batman or a Superman.
Yeah, it was a different set of characters from a different time, and it's hard to eventually they figured out some ways to make DC hipper, but it was at least as of the 60s, especially maybe the mid 60s. Marvel was really the only game in town when it came to being really snappy and trendy. I mean, that changes a little bit when Batman, the TV show, comes on in 1966 and becomes this campy cultural phenomenon. But you are right that Stan was better at tapping into the zeitgeist, at least initially.
And even now, the Marvel movies are better than the DC movies, strangely enough.
Matter of opinion for people, but definitely in terms of mainstream cultural acceptance, the Marvel movies have been much more of a formidable entity. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of that is stuff that's just baked in now of how these characters work, or at least the tradition of looking at Marvel as the world outside your window, as opposed to a place of gods and myths. Although, of course, they are, you know, it's all a difference of degree as opposed to distinction. But, you know, or maybe it is distinction. I don't know. But you make a good point.
When I was a kid, I always thought that Stan Lee was Marvel Comics, that it was his company. But in fact, he was just an employee of the company.
He was just an employee. Yeah. His cousin-in-law, Martin Goodman, was the owner of the company that became Marvel. You know, it went under various names, both the company itself and the comics publishing arm, which was a subdivision of it, because it was an overall publishing empire. And Stan never owned it. There was a moment in the late 90s when Stan was at his first post-Marvel company, and they were doing really well in the stock market, and Marvel had been really suffering after going bankrupt a few years prior. There was a little bit of discussion at that point of, well, maybe this second company should buy Marvel. They didn't jump at it, and you know, the rest is history. So Stan was never an owner, and didn't, you know, he took a salary. He was not getting people see these movies, the Marvel movies, and they see at the end that Stan has an executive producer credit, and they just know that Stan is somehow synonymous with Marvel, and they assume he made a lot of money off of these things. He really didn't. He initially had a percentage deal where he was going to make 10% of the get 10% of the profits for movies and TV shows adapted from Marvel comics. And then for various reasons in a lawsuit, he ceded those rights and just got a one-time cash payout. And then subsequently was making no money on these movies and TV shows. And he was not the owner. And that was something that kind of bugged him. He at one point was the publisher and president of the company, but it was owned by another corporation. He was always somebody else's employee.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Abraham Reisman. He's the author of True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. Stan Lee, the man behind the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man.
When the first Spider-Man movie came out, the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie, which I thought was really good and probably one of the first really good comic book adaptations on film, it did say created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. They got equal credit. Did they get any money?
That brings me to an interesting thing. Marvel and other Marvel studios that were doing Marvel movies sometimes would give cash payments to creators, and still do sometimes do that, but it's capricious. I mean, there are times when creators have historically been able to sign deals where they get like profit sharing agreements about the characters they create. Anyway, to your specific question, when I went to profile Steve Ditko for an article a few years ago, I went to his office. He was still alive at the time and had a little studio in Manhattan, in Midtown Manhattan, where you could go. And although he would never speak to you on the record as a journalist, people had told me you could go and meet him and talk to him. And he just wouldn't let you publish any of it. So I went to knock on his door and waited out there for a while, didn't know whether he was inside or not. No one was responding. And in that time, I ran into one of his neighbors at the office building who said that she once accidentally got a piece of mail that was intended for Ditko and opened it up. And it was for this absurd amount of money from Sony. Because they were, you know, as far as I know, they were under no obligation. There's no public known obligation that they had to pay him, but as of the late 2010s, it may have been that they just wanted to, I don't know, that for some reason that was what they were doing. But but Stan, to my knowledge, was not getting payments from these things. He was not making money off of these movies. He was getting credited in them, but
and he was in them.
And but he'd get paid scale for that. Basically, he would show up and do a cameo and get paid peanuts. He was doing it for the love of the game, for the fame, for whatever. These were not movies that he was making money off of, as far as anybody can really tell.
Well, we mentioned earlier the sort of comic book scandals of the 1950s, in which the industry was tarred as the progenitor of juvenile delinquency.
Yes.
And therefore, lots of people stopped working in comics or were ashamed of working in comics. Mm-hmm. And Stan Lee continued to work in comics under that kind of cloud. I mean, he was never particularly proud of working in comics. He wished that he was working, doing something else.
Over and over, yeah.
And so how did that affect his personality?
I think it's more that his personality affected it, right? I mean, he wanted to be known and respected and admired for things that he thought were serious and worthy of being placed on a pedestal. And that was, you know, being a movie exec or writing a movie or being a television programmer or, you know, things, or even, you know, writing a novel, writing a book of poems. He really did not historically have all that much unique respect or love for the comic book industry or for the superhero genre. He over and over again would talk about what a terrible industry comics was, either in private or in semi-public, you know, like at speeches or whatever. But in his public persona, he would talk up comics all the time. But that just behind closed doors was not how he was. I mean, I've heard and read plenty of quotes of him saying, other than the comics I was working on, I didn't read comics when I was working on them. He stopped reading comics after he was no longer working on comics and was doing other things. He would pitch things and the pitches were never comics and they were never superhero stories. He really wanted to break out. I mean, he tried to start a textbook company, for Christ's sakes. I mean, he really wanted to be successful in kind of anything but comic books. And it never really worked out for him. It's a core, I don't know if the word's tragedy, but it's certainly an interesting contrast that the one thing he was really known for was a thing that he just didn't really have a ton of respect for and wanted to just use as a jumping off point to something else.
What about Kirby or Ditko? Were they proud of their work in comic books?
Yes, in different ways. Kirby really believed in the comics art form, and he, you know, was one of its early pioneers going back to the late 30s and the creation of Captain America. And then in the 50s, you know, him and Joe Simon pioneering the romance comic and any number of other developments that Jack made. Now, you know, Jack also, you know, would have loved to make movies as well, but he had more of a respect for and innovator's eye for the comics medium, just as a medium, and saw its power. And for Ditko, it's hard to say because Ditko was a very mysterious and reclusive guy. He did, you know, he would write these little pamphlets where he would, or letters where he would, expound on his views about things. And he was this big Randian objectivist and very principled guy who didn't talk about his personal life basically at all. But he would release these missives, and they, you know, it was clear that he respected comics a lot and knew he was good at comics and saw the power of comics. I don't know whether he loved comics, but he, you know, would do these didactic comics, these comics that would be intended to teach you harsh political lessons or moral lessons. And he seemed to really believe that comics could have that kind of power. And, Stan, just by comparison, was less interested in pushing the boundaries of comics or saying that comics could have, you know, a unique way of getting to people beyond just this was the medium that he'd been tossed into. Because mind you, he got this job. He started in comics in 1939, 1940. Just because it was a family gig. I mean, like I said, his cousin-in-law was the owner. His uncle was the owner's right-hand man. And, you know, the uncle basically just told him one day, hey, they're looking for somebody to do an assistant gig. You know, go do this. And, or it may well have even been just, you know, the uncle, you know, Stan's mom telling the uncle, hey, you got to get this kid off my hands for a few hours every day, whatever. It was not because Stan was sitting around going, I love the nascent medium of comic books and I want to work in them. It was a job. It was like any other random job that he got in that period. It just so happened that was the job that stuck.
One of the supporting characters in your story that has kind of a poignant aspect is Larry Lieber.
Stan's brother, yes, his younger brother.
Talk about him a little bit.
So Larry was almost a decade younger than Stan, and they had a very strained relationship. It was not explosive, but they were not close. Larry was kind enough to speak to me for about, you know, 5.5 hours all told you know, I will be forever grateful for that. And he told me a lot of things that fell into the category of, you know, an interviewer's big, you know, biggest dream, which is someone saying to you, I've never told anyone this, but, you know, I got a lot of that. And what it added up to was a story of two brothers who really had a lot. They obviously had a lot in common because they were blood. And, you know, one thing they had in common was both of them didn't really care much about comics, but, and worked in comics anyway. But Larry is not a salesman. Larry is fun to talk to, but is not the kind of raconteur that Stan was. Larry doesn't want the spotlight. You know, Larry's an artist in addition to just being a writer. And it is a sad story. It's the story of two people who should have been bound, probably. Or, I mean, that's the ideal scenario for families, perhaps. But he and Stan didn't. It's not, again, it wasn't that they fought viciously. It was just Stan didn't really want anything to do with Larry. Well, that's a little extreme. He wanted to work with Larry and have Larry work for him intermittently. But when it came to socializing and when it came to emotional closeness, he was not interested in Larry. He was not really interested in his family. I mean, his family. There's an anecdote that Larry told me about having a conversation with Stan in the 70s when Stan was the publisher, no longer the editor of Marvel, and asking for more work. Stan saying that he couldn't do it and, you know, it's out of his hands. He's just the publisher. And then Larry spoke to an editor and the editor told him, look, everyone around here is of the opinion that Stan only cares about himself and his family and you're not included in the latter. And the people who were in that family were just Stan's wife, Joan, and his daughter, JC, to whom he was extremely devoted and would do anything for them practically. But Larry, you know, according to Larry, Stan in all of their 87 odd years together, never once told Larry that he loved him. You know, it was a very distant relationship, but Larry was a keen observer of Stan. And those insights proved very useful, but yeah, there's a lot of stories in there about Larry and Stan where Larry was telling them to me and he just broke out into tears. I mean, he was very, it was hard for Larry that Stan did not care about him all that much. And, you know, Larry would talk about how Stan would come to New York Larry lives in this studio apartment, this micro apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And Stan would come to New York to do convention appearances and wouldn't even tell Larry that he was coming to town. Larry would hear from a third party that Stan was going to be in the same city as him. And, you know, maybe Larry would watch the live stream and that was the closest he would get. So anyway, I could go on and on about Larry, who's a fascinating character in and of his own right. But yeah, it's a poignant tale.
The book, and it's really a good book and it's been very well received. There was a great piece in New Yorker magazine. The book is called True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee and the author, Abraham Reisman. What are you going to do next?
I'm already on a contract for a second book. I'm writing a book for Simon & Schuster for their Atria imprint called Ringmaster, The Life and Times of Vince McMahon. It's a biography of Vince McMahon, the emperor of professional wrestling in America. So that's a similar sort of self-made character of a person who blurs fact and fiction in his tales about himself and who, you know, really revolutionized an art form, in this case, professional wrestling, and has left a controversial legacy. So beyond that, there are a lot of differences between the two, but I would hope that people who enjoyed the first one might take a look at the second one. It'll be a very different kind of biography because there's no big archive of Vince's personal materials that's publicly available the way there is for Stan at the American Heritage Center, where his archives are stored. And also, you know, Vince is an intensely private guy who, you know, what I'm getting at is it'll be a different kind of story because there's different information available, but I think it's going to be a rich one as well. And yeah, that's what I should be working on right now. Although all the book promo for book one has been keeping my mind a little distracted.
Well, I hope that you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I would love to. That would be great.
The book again is called True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. Abraham Reisman, the author, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Book.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.